talked about classical apologetics, evidentialism. Classical is the two-step approach, defend God, then give historical evidence. Evidentialism, you focus mainly on historical evidences, but you can provide evidence for God, but that's, you start with the historical evidences. We also said there's some subcategories of these traditional approaches, like the dialogical and the cumulative case. Now, we talked last week and the week before about presuppositionalism. But remember, there's three types. You have the Vantillian type, transcendental presuppositionalism. The Clarkian, dogmatic presuppositionalism. He loves rationalism, but you can't reason to all. You can't reason forever to everything. You can't reason to your first principles that was set up in infinite regress, so you got to dogmatically presuppose your first principles. But that evolved into scripturalism, where truth can only be found in the scriptures. And Gordon Clark was asked, well, how do you know that's a Bible in your hands for you to presuppose what it says? And his response was, what Bible? So that's it's just a scary, scary position. He even defined humans as a set of presuppositions that are... Phil Fernandez is a set of presuppositions, set of statements that are true about what we call Phil Fernandez. Well, you got a set of propositions that are true about a rock. So it's just different, so he's defined person in a way that nobody else did. Now, a lot of people that are called presuppositionalists today are actually verificationalists. Okay, and that's what we're talking about now, but keep in mind, though, there are a lot of people, I like presuppositional arguments. That doesn't make me a presuppositionalist. According to Gordon Clark, he pretty much, maybe I'm using hyperbole, but just a little bit of exaggeration there. He pretty much acted like Van Til was going to hell, and Van Til acted like he was going to hell. So one presuppositional camp, not only are they condemning classical apologetics and evidentialism as being godless, blasphemous systems, but they even did that to each other. So if somebody says they're a presuppositionalist, I have a lot of my former students that claim to be presuppositionalists now. I say, well, what kind of presuppositionalist are you? They might say, well, Clarkian or Vantillian, but then I find them using the Kalam cosmological argument, a classical argument, and I realize they're just being eclectic in their approach. You can be a classical apologist or an evidentialist and borrow from the presuppositionalist. And you can love the presuppositionalist. That doesn't make you a presuppositionalist. To be a Vantillian or a Clarkian presuppositionalist, you have to say, my way or the highway. And that's one of the reasons why John Frame and Francis Schaeffer, why they're not really presuppositionalists, because these guys, you argue, classical apologists and evidentialists, the traditional types, we argue from something to God. Presuppositionists said, no, you can only argue from God to something else. You have to presuppose God. These guys say, yeah, that's right, you can only argue from God, but they're using God not dogmatically as a presupposition, but as an explanation, a proposed explanation, a hypothesis, and they're willing to test it. So verificationalism is like a halfway house between traditional apologetics and presuppositionalism, okay? So these guys are willing, there's times when you'll actually think that they're classical apologists. Sometimes they will even use classical arguments. The mortal sin for any Vantillian or Clarkian presuppositionals. And so now I'll talk about Edward J. Carnell. This guy, really, really sad that he died so young. He was only like 48 years old. and Edward J. Carnell. And he was very eclectic in his approach to defending the faith. At Westminster Theological Seminary, he studied under Cornelius Van Til. Okay? And that's where he got his starting point for his apologetic system, the triune God of the Bible. He also learned how to use the test of non-contradiction while studying under Gordon Clark at Wheaton College. So now here's this brilliant young guy. He was the youngest guy, by the way, to become the president of a fully accredited graduate school when he became the president of Fuller, I think at age 29. And so he studied under Van Til at Westminster, Gordon Clark at Wheaton. Then he did his PhD studies at Boston University under Edgar Brightman. And from there he got his test for empirical fit. We'll talk about that a little bit later. And then finally he did his doctorate theology research at Harvard, where he studied the thought of Soren Kierkegaard and Reinhold Niebuhr. And he learned to appreciate the importance of worldviews to one's personal or existential experience. Now, he combined the insights of these great thinkers to produce his own unique and hard-to-classify apologetics methodology. But he starts with the Christian presupposition like Van Til and Clark. However, it's not an unquestioned presupposition. It's a hypothesis that he allows to be tested, and that's why Carnell should be classified as more of a verificationalist. Okay, and now when you propose a hypothesis, it has to be non-contradictory, for reality cannot be contradictory, says Carnell. But it also must fit the facts of human experience. Both the internal facts, our intellectual and moral experience, as well as the external facts. Carnell agreed with Gordon Clark that all non-Christian belief systems ultimately result in skepticism, but he disagreed with Clark on the issue of common ground, whereas Gordon Clark argued there's no common ground between believers and non-believers. Carnell insisted that there was. And those consist in the innate and changeless truths found in the human mind. So he disagreed with Thomas Aquinas that we start life as a blank slate, and he believed that we have innate ideas of truth, goodness, and beauty. And these ideas are common to all humans since we were created in God's image. Even though we're fallen, we still bear God's image enough to have these innate ideas of logic, ethics, and beauty. Okay? And this common ground gives us a point of contact with the world and with the non-believer so that we can argue with them and test their worldview, but also show that the Christian worldview passes the test. And so this non-contradictory hypothesis, which best fits all the relevant facts of experience, both the empirical facts, the facts open to the five senses, and the psychological facts, which also have the least amount of difficulties, is the most systematically consistent worldview. So he's looking for systematic consistency here, okay? He looks at the experience of humans and the transformed lives of people through Christianity from different cultures, and the best explanation for that is that Christianity is true. He says that the existence of science, the fact that science works, is best explained by Christian assumptions. If Christianity is true, we should expect the categories of the mind to really put us in touch with what's going on in the world and knowledge of the world. His evidence for the Bible, he believed the best explanation of human history, if you want to try to make sense out of it, is found in the biblical description And so without the biblical perspective, human history appears to be void of meaning. He says, even though the Bible is written long ago, it's still relevant to human needs thousands of years later. Its insights transcend time. He found evidence for Jesus being God incarnate and the fact that he did claim to be God. And this is confirmed by independent witnesses, the Gospels, Paul's writings, and other New Testament books. And Jesus confirmed this by fulfilling Old Testament prophecies, performing miracles and rising from the dead. So you see Carnell doing things that no presuppositionalist would do. He's actually providing historical evidences for Jesus, okay? But never once is he, this is an important thing for him, he does not believe in building God one brick at a time, okay? So he would argue, you know, that the classical apologist is building God one brick at a time. There's got to be an eternal, uncaused cause. Then we find out this being is a moral being, an intelligent being. He's like, no, I'm gonna presuppose the whole God right from the start, the triune God revealed in the scriptures. But he is willing to open it up for testing, something that true presuppositionalists would not do, and that's why he's a verificationalist. Carnell looked at Christianity and man's psychological needs. He believed that only Christianity meets man's psychological needs. Carnell, I would rate second place behind Blaise Pascal as the greatest psychological apologist who ever lived. So in other words, even though he's a verificationalist, he's willing to use, he's very eclectic, willing to use other approaches, including psychological approaches. And so he says that Christianity alone meets man's psychological needs, for only the Christian worldview can rescue us from boredom, despair, anxiety, and guilt. The world can only offer man with despair or diversions, things that distract us from our real problems. Only in Christianity can man's greatest needs be met. He says, look, man needs to be eternally significant and eternally loved, and only in Christ can we have that hope beyond the grave. To be eternally significant, we're children of the eternal God, and only in Christ can we be eternally loved. And so he's saying man's deepest, you know, Solomon said that God put eternity in our hearts, and so we're human. We think about eternal issues, and Carnell is saying that apart from the God of the Bible, man's deepest psychological needs cannot be met. Okay, it's really sad too, because he put way too much faith in the secular psychology of his day and went through a lot of electroshock therapies and ended up dying of an overdose of his medication. Most believe it wasn't suicide. He just would often forget that he took his medication, and they had him on some heavy stuff. And but there are a lot of brilliant thinkers that do battle with depression. And not all, but there are some. And then Christianity, a man's moral experience, he believed that only Christianity makes sense of our moral experience. All humans make universal moral value judgments. That makes no sense if there is no universal moral standard. And so there's got to be, we appeal our case basically before an administrator of justice, and that can only be a personal being to give moral commands. So even though, like Clark and Van Til, Carnell presupposed the existence of the triune God who revealed himself in Scripture, but unlike Clark and Van Til, he was willing to submit his starting point to testing. So he's not really a presuppositionalist. He's a verificationalist like John Frame and like Francis Schaeffer, okay? And, but he was not just a verificationalist, he was also very eclectic in his defense. He was willing to use historical evidences for Christianity, philosophical evidences, ethical evidences, and psychological evidence for the truth claims of Christianity. So it's best to classify Edward J. Carnell as a verificational apologist who is willing to use other approaches. Now, others call him a combinationalist, okay? So this is another classification that I give. Combinationalism, okay? And the difference between cumulative case and combinationalism combines different methodologies. So one of the last chapters in the book, I cover that, and I just mentioned, hey, here's a bunch of guys we already mentioned, like even Norman Geisler. Not only is he a classical apologist who uses this two-step approach, but he's also somewhat of a scientific apologist. He uses scientific evidence for God. And then he's willing to, you know, refute non-Christian belief systems, so he does a little bit of comparative religious apologetics. So when everything's said and done, I would argue most apologists today are actually, if you really cornered them, they're combinationalists, though I wouldn't classify all of them as combinationalists unless they've actually put something in print using these other approaches. Okay? Yeah.
So for someone who claimed that Christianity delivers us from boredom, despair, anxiety, and guilt, doesn't his death wall and treatment for depression hurt his argument in the long run?
I don't think it hurts his argument.
I guess I'm wondering how we ought to answer that charge in case despite the individual.
I don't think it hurts his argument any more than the guy who says Christianity is the true worldview, and Christ can empower you to live a godly life, and then he leaves his wife for another woman. It doesn't really take from the truth of what he said, but what it does is it makes him, he didn't practice what he preached. It makes him somewhat of a hypocrite. Now, I wouldn't call a person who's suffering from depression a hypocrite, but I would say that one side of the coin is he recognized the world of depression more than someone like me who doesn't suffer much from depression. I have loved ones that suffer a lot from depression, okay? And he realized that his place of comfort was Christ. Having said that, he should have taken his own medicine, I think. But it was at a day, you know, in the 1940s, 1950s, early 1960s, they thought these psychologists were brilliant. I mean, you can watch Gregory Peck movies, which the ultimate authority is nothing to do with the Word of God. It's Freudian psychoanalysis. And it's just, you watch just these movies, the hero just gets psychoanalyzed, and it's just like, saves the day, and all these insane people are going to be saved through Freudian psychoanalysis, and it's like, wow, wouldn't it be nice if that worked, but it didn't. Been there, done that. And but in a movie in the late 1950s, that's what they were thinking. And so I think it was unfortunate, and it's a scary thing for Christian academia, where our desire to please God and our respect for God must infinitely outweigh our respect for the wisdom of man and our desire to please the wisdom of man. Right now, there are evangelical apologists that are watering down inerrancy. And I think it's because they love the wisdom of man too much, or they want to long for the respect of the wisdom of man. And so it's kind of like philosophers and theologians are rubbing shoulders with psychologists in his day, And, you know, he bought into some of that stuff. And
would that be, you take the depression from that?
Well, he had depression.
Yeah.
It's just that basically, I don't think electroshock therapy is the best way to go. And probably with the medication that they had him on, you know, you would hope. But see, the thing is, too, is, you know, there actually, like an artist like Van Gogh, there's something, and sometimes it borders on the demonic, but very gifted people usually suffer somewhere else. And I don't know if that's just part of the fallen creation, but there are people you would say, that guy has everything I want. And anything anybody in their right mind would want. Why is he miserable? I just saw a homeless guy missing half his teeth. He's poor, and he's got twice as much joy as this guy over here.
But and, sometimes it's a habit.
Yeah.
I talked to him. I was depressed deeply for 7 years. Every day woke up and said, how can I kill myself?
Yeah.
I went into a hole so deep that somebody pulled me out.
Yeah.
And for me, it was a habit.
Yeah. And it's probably different with a lot of different people. Sometimes there are, you know, I think sometimes we can make bad choices, which could then set chemical reactions in our brain. You know, so sometimes bad decisions can lead to physical effects, chemical reactions in our brain. But other times, it's the chemical reaction. Something's wrong with the chemicals in our brain that could cause the depression. And so sometimes, if there's medication that could just get your chemicals balanced, that's not a bad thing.
I
think this guy came pretty close to worshiping secular psychology, and in the end, that's what killed him.
I would like to see his childhood.
Because
a lot of times, we build those. I talked to a girl the other day, got into drugs really bad, had built some really guilt and putting herself down habits.
Yeah.
And I said, you have to stop that.
Yeah. And I don't know what his would be like, but I suspect it had something to do with his genius. Two doctoral degrees from two leading universities way before he's 29 years old, established scholar in his field to where they make him the president of a university at the age of 29. So, you know, with me, my problem is I can't stop thinking. So I have to be on a certain medication that prevents me from having what appear to be seizures at night. And so there's a medication that relaxes my mind and my body, and I go to sleep. And without that, they... Swedish Medical Center said I don't get more than, you know, 20 minutes of sleep, and if I lay down for 8 hours, now I lay down for 5 hours and I'm out for 5 hours. So, but at the same time, this was at a time. So I'm not throwing out psychology, but what I'm saying is psychology has its place. This was at a time when it was the world respected Freudian psychoanalysis more in the 1940s, and they respected the Bible. And yet, this guy would say, if you want to find deliverance, find meaning in life, it can only be found in Christ. And like I say, they do not believe he committed suicide. His wife said she would often catch him going to take his medication, and she'd say, honey, you just took your medication. He said, oh, I did? She'd say, yeah, and they put it back. But they were giving him such high dosages that it didn't take too much.
How old was he?
What? He was 47. Yeah. And by the way, with the books he wrote and what he accomplished, some would say he was en route to be the greatest Christian intellectual, greatest Christian thinker of the 20th century. Others would say he was, even though he died at age 47. Now, grant, he outlived Blaise Pascal by 8 years. So, I think Aquinas died when he was 49. So I outlived all three of these guys. I'm a Methuselah now, so now. But whatever the case, so he's a verificationalist. At the same time, he's also a combinationalist. Now, let me make this clear, though. Combinationalism, you combine different methodologies. Cumulative case apologists, you combine different arguments. So in other words, like my cumulative case for God, I use 7, 8, 9 different aspects of human experience rather than putting all my eggs in one basket, one argument for God's existence. Okay? So cumulative case, you combine different arguments. But combinationalism is when you combine different methods. Okay? So, you know, we even mentioned, like, Francis Schaeffer also used cultural apologetics, where you say that when the Judeo-Christian worldview, the biblical worldview, is applied to a culture in almost a universal fashion, the culture prospers. But when it begins to turn its back on the Judeo-Christian worldview, it starts to decay. And I do that in my book, God, Government, and the Road to Tyranny, Christian View of Government and Morality. That's my cultural apologetics. Whereas I'm more of a classical apologist, in my works like The Atheist Delusion or The God Who Sits Enthroned or No Other Gods, okay? And so you could say that, well, Franz is a classical apologist who is also a combinationalist because he uses cultural apologetics as well. So, okay, now C.S. Lewis. Now, what you got to understand here with verificationalism, Schaeffer, Carnell, and Frame, these three guys, these three verificationalists, are Presbyterians.
Wow.
Okay? And Van Til and Clark are Presbyterians, okay? So these guys are verificationalists because they were trained by presuppositionalists, but they didn't fully accept it. So they allowed their hypothesis, their presupposition, to be tested. So they're not really presuppositionalists, okay? Having said that, C.S. Lewis, who is not a Presbyterian, and by the way, the Presbyterian view that regeneration precedes faith, that God either regenerates you or he doesn't, it's got nothing to do with your will, and then once you're regenerated, you have a whole new worldview, a whole new presupposition, it makes sense for Presbyterians who are Calvinists to be presuppositionalists and all. But from a whole different school of thought, C.S. Lewis was just a really brilliant guy who read classical apologetics, but he himself, when he explained what he was trying to do, he was also a verificationalist. So he's the main verificationist that I'm talking about that didn't come out of the presuppositional camp.
Well, I mean, okay? he was Anglican, though, so I mean, there's a heavy Calvinist influence there that he kind of emerged untouched from.
Yeah, he emerged untouched from it, but I do know Anglican. I do know Anglican pastors that even they remain untouched by the Calvinist thing. Although I would say it is prevalent.
He's like their founding theologian.
Yeah, Lewis was very big on free will. But for him, what caused him to be a verificationalist, I think, was just the confidence in science and that the scientific method is basically hypothesis testing. So Schaefer also would talk about it the same way as Lewis, but Lewis would talk about his method of defending the faith as finding the key to unlock the door. You're trying to get into a room, and then you've never been in the room, and you find the key, and it unlocks everything for you. And so he would say things like, we not only see, he compared the Son of God, the Son, to the sun, the S-U-N, and Lewis would say, we not only see the sun by its light, we also see everything else by its light. Well, he would say the same about the Son of God. We not only see the Son of God by his light, he reveals himself to us, but he is also the key through which we see everything else. So C.S. Lewis would say that Christianity is the key that not only opens the door to eternal life and spiritual truths, but it also helps us to make sense out of it's the missing piece in the puzzle that makes sense out of everything else. So the way he described what he was doing actually puts him in the presuppositional camp. Now, Lewis, if you want to read Lewis's philosophical works, the four main books I would recommend is right there in your textbook: The Problem of Pain, where he's dealing with the problem of evil; Miracles, where he's arguing that miracles are possible, and then he goes from there to argue for the truth of Christianity; Mere Christianity, his defense of the essential truths of the Christian faith; and then his kind of cultural apologetic work, The Abolition of Man. And it's almost to the point where I would not even consider you a solid apologist, at least on a professional level, if you hadn't read these four books. And his work on miracles, he talked about atheism, who's the worldview called naturalism, the belief that only natural causes exist, and hence miracles are impossible. But then he argues that naturalism's arguments against miracles fail. He argues natural laws are descriptive. They describe the way things generally occur. They're not prescriptive. They don't demand that they have to occur a certain way. So the natural laws themselves do not rule out miracles. If a God exists who set the laws of nature in motion, he can interrupt or suspend these laws anytime he chooses to do so. Now, in his book on miracles, his book called Miracles, he uses the argument from reason that we have no belief to trust in what our reasoning is telling us. Our reasoning is telling us that no basis to trust in the validity of human reason, unless reason itself has a rational cause, okay? And this gets back to Richard Taylor's, Welcome to Wales illustration. The lady's never been to Wales, she's on a train, she looks on the side of the mountain, the white stones spell out, Welcome to Wales, okay? Well, if that represents reason, if she believes that those rocks got there accidentally, then she has no reason to believe she's entering Wells. So if we believe our reason, our thinking ability, got here by accident, then we have no reason to trust what our reason is telling us. But if we believe our reason has a rational cause, then, we can trust what our reason is telling us. So the atheist is actually shooting himself in the foot by trusting in the validity of human reason. He has no basis. He believes, you had rocks, you had water, you had dirt, And then given enough time, man evolves his reasoning ability. But reason came from non-rational causes. So there's no reason to trust what your reason is telling you. And but if our reason had a rational cause, eternal reason, the mind of God, then we can trust in our reason. So he uses reason to argue for the existence of God. He also has a moral argument for God in his book Mere Christianity, where he talks about that we all make moral judgments when we condemn the actions of others, and that without a universal moral law, fulfilling promises or honoring treaties would hold no value. The fact that humans make excuses for breaking the moral law implies they acknowledge its existence. Okay? He talks about our morality is just, it's more than just, our moral conscience is more than just an instinct. Sometimes our instincts say flee, and instead we go into the burning fire to rescue somebody. And he says that moral law cannot be identified as a law of nature. The laws of nature are descriptive, they're not prescriptive. But moral laws are prescriptive, they prescribe the way humans ought to act. So the universal moral law is real. Moral laws come from minds, they don't come from mere matter. There must be a mind that exists behind the universal moral law. And the problem of pain, he deals with the problem of evil and human suffering. He says that if God did not permit evil, man would have no free will. Lewis believed it would be morally unworthy for God to force his will upon mankind. And then God allows evil for purposes of a greater good. There are some good things that could not be obtained in this world if God did not allow evil. And then God often uses evil and suffering to draw people to himself through their suffering and pain. Lewis stated in his The Problem of Pain, God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks in our conscience, but shouts in our pain. It is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. And so this is one of the reasons why the poor were so much more open to the gospel when Jesus walked the earth. He says the poor are much more open to the gospel today. And the problem of evil and human suffering, that sounds real good in America and Europe, where Christianity is in decline. But in third world countries, where suffering is at a peak, that's where the gospel is growing in leaps and bounds. Now, Lewis's trilemma in his Mere Christianity, he argued that Jesus claimed to be God incarnate. And Lewis was an expert in classical literature, so he read mythology. And he could see that the gospel authors were not writing legends or mythology. So he ruled that out, so it's a trilemma. He realized that, legend is not even a possibility. Jesus claimed to be God. Either he's a liar, or he's a lunatic, or he's God, okay? And those are the only options that he's given us. Lewis stated it this way on page 56 of Mere Christianity. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on a level with the man who says he is a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him or kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. Okay? And so, so Lewis, he's a verificational apologist, but he's also a combinationalist in that in his Abolition of Man, he uses cultural apologetics. This was a book, he wrote The Abolition of Man in the 1940s, and it was because of an English textbook designed for, I believe, grammar school children. But the book taught the students to reject absolute truth and traditional values and to embrace moral relativism. Lewis said, you know, if textbooks like this become more and more used in our schools, it's going to produce a race of men without chests. What he meant there is men without moral consciences. And he's going to dehumanize human beings. He's going to abolish man. It would be a new species of man, the abolition of man. I think he's using hyperbole there. He gets slammed by philosophers who act like he's talking like literally. But such education would be the destruction of the society that accepted it. The rejection of all values leaves man free to recreate himself and his values. When this power is placed in the hands of those who rule, their subjects will be totally at their mercy. This sounds so Nietzschean that you would expect to see Nietzsche's name all over. I can't remember ever seeing Nietzsche's name in C.S. Lewis's writings. It's probably there somewhere. But this is exactly what Nietzsche said, but coming at it from an atheist standpoint, that if God is dead, if God doesn't exist, then traditional values are dead, absolute truth is dead, meaning is dead. But then Nietzsche thought, that, well, then those, through their will to power, the supermen will create their own values. Well, what Nietzsche's looking forward to, C.S. Lewis and Francis Schaeffer after him would say, no, that's hell on earth. That's not heaven. That's hell on earth. And Lewis also saw the rejection of traditional values would give a new purpose for science. Science is a lot like magic in that both science and magic try to control nature. Man tries to exercise power over nature and control nature. Well, the last thing in nature to be controlled is man. And when science is being done, man tries to free himself from superstition and tries to understand and control nature. But once you take God out of the picture, then there's nothing to stop. There's no moral boundaries for science. And all of a sudden, science will fully attempt to control man. And we're talking about things now, genetic engineering and transhumanism, animal-human hybrids, machine-human hybrids. But both science and magic try to conquer nature, and the last thing in nature to be conquered will be man. So C.S. Lewis predicted that science will become an instrument through which a few hundreds of men will rule billions of men. So the few, the conditioners, the man-molders of the new age will control the billions. So science is going to be used by future rulers to suppress the freedoms of the masses. Let me see.
That is so big today.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And Lewis was saying this in the 1940s. Now, the first time I presented my paper on the death of Western civilization, where I refer to Nietzsche's work, C.S. Lewis's work, and Francis Schaeffer's work, it was Stanley Grenz, a leading theologian. He died, I don't know, about 10 years ago, but he contested my paper when I presented it at Multnomah, that a meeting, regional meeting of the Evangelical Theological Society. And so we butt heads, and then two of his guys joined him, and then two guys joined me. They turned out to be two J.P. Moreland guys out of Biola. Stanley Grant's objection was, he said, well, don't you think Schaefer and Lewis were right for their generation, but not for now? And I said, well, they were predicting what was going to come down in our generation. So if they were right then, they had to be right now. So you can't have it both ways. You can say they're both idiots and you disagree with them, but you can't call them brilliant thinkers who were really sharp for their day because they were saying what's going to happen tomorrow. And tomorrow's here.
So and did they take science and try to do the same thing like they did?
Well, science is climate. Science is being used. Science, we got pseudoscience with the environmentalist movement and global warming and climate change. All they want to do with that is just enslave mankind. You know, Al Gore wants to fly around, and so does Leonardo DiCaprio. They want to fly around in their jets and burn more fuel than I'm probably going to burn in my entire lifetime to try to keep Phil Fernandez out of a car. And he doesn't even really, you know, him and Al Gore, I don't even think Al Gore's in the know. I think I don't mean to be disrespectful, but I think this is what they would call a useful idiot. Somebody, the man molders of the new age, the conditioners who want to control everybody and enslave everybody, they get guys who mean well, but aren't the smartest guys on the planet Earth, and they convince them this is what's best for mankind. So these guys go out and proclaim this stuff. Now, I do think that there's some people that are in the know.
If you want to have a bit of fun looking up governmental experimentation with like mind control and stuff like that, look up Project MKUltra. MKUltra will give you everything you need to know that as C.S. Lewis was writing The Abolition of Man, the CIA was experimenting with drugs and truth serums and stuff like that.
LSD, experimenting with LSD, young guys. Some of these guys ended up jumping out of windows to their death. And then the CIA would deny that, you know. But programming people to be assassins. The United States government forced sterilization, usually done by state governments and all, but from 1907 to 1973. We sterilized over 70,000 disabled people from having children against their will. So there's certainly the Kinsey reports. Just listen to that, Eric Metaxas, on the way over. And
the what report?
Kinsey reports. That's for the whole sexual revolution. And Kinsey was using a lot of research on infants, only several months old, as to whether or not they could be sexually aroused and things of that sort. And so you could only get that information by either paying people to be pedophiles, to sexually abuse children, or by his communicating with pedophiles. But Kinsey is viewed as a saint.
I just read today that they were using dolls in prisons.
I don't even want to know about it. Whatever the case, though, science is learning how to do things, and if we take God out of the picture, we don't ask, okay, is it right to do this or to do that? And so, you know, are we going to have designer babies? Are we going to have animal-human hybrids? We already have animal-human hybrids in the embryonic and fetal stage. Are we going to bring some to birth? I would be shocked if there are not animal-human hybrids that have already been brought to birth. And some could be the U.S. government, could be the Chinese government. Our government's experimented on humans. But basically, it's just the tip of the iceberg. But I believe what Francis and Schaefer called the death of man And what C.S. Lewis called the abolition of man, we are seeing that come down in our midst. And when a society that knows better, a society that has been saturated by the Bible, rejects God, we lose all touch with who we are. So if we don't know who God is, we don't even know who we are anymore. So this is why we got to the point now, we don't even know which bathroom to use. I don't know if this day's going to come up where Christians are going to say, you can't go to the cities. Because if you go to the cities, if they see our Jesus bumper sticker, they're going to bash our windows, and we're going to be viewed as the bad guys who are guilty of hate speech. And if we go to the cities, we can't use the public bathrooms because we have no idea. I mean, and, you know, people would say, oh, yeah, right. Hey, in Europe right now, okay, in Europe, you have some young Arab Muslim males, supposed refugees, that are mistreating ladies big time, and nobody wants to bring them to account. And so, you know, you throw out God's moral laws, and it has a tremendous dehumanizing effect on mankind. Now, so Lewis said traditional values will be replaced by the arbitrary wills of the few who rule over the billions, and this will abolish man and bring about the world of post-humanity. What he's talking about is dictators treating humans like subhumans, like something less than human beings should be treated. Look at what we do to the unborn babies. Okay? Taxpayers' money, until Donald Trump came into the picture, taxpayers' money was supporting Planned Parenthood to not only kill unborn babies, but then they were making money on the side selling their body parts. And then they could find out they get a little bit more money if the organs are fresher. So maybe we could start, you know, bringing these babies out alive and then taking stuff out of them. And exactly what C.S. Lewis talked about.
So is that the big fight today about against Donald Trump part of that?
Yeah, Donald Trump, the big, you know, and I'm not a Donald Trump fan. I voted for the guy, but I'm not a Donald Trump fan. But I think he's better than any neocon internationalists like the Mitt Romneys, McCains, the Bushes. And he's certainly better than the socialist Democrats like the Clintons and the Obamas. I would be much more in favor of a constitutionalist like Rand Paul. But apparently, I used to think you had to be a constitutionalist for the neocon right, the neoconservative right, and the liberal Democrats to both team up against you. Now I found out, as long as you're not the whooping boy of either one of those two groups, and as long as they're not doing your thinking for you, both sides are going to come at you with both barrels firing away. And so basically, he is, when he says America first and he's a nationalist, he wants to use the American taxpayers' money for America's best interest, not the rest of the world. And he also doesn't believe that we should be using our resources and our military to try to recreate nations around the world in our image. That's their business. And so he's got both sides that really feel threatened by that, because he's not an internationalist, he's a nationalist. But certainly the social democrats, the socialist democrats are really upset that he is opposed to abortion, and so, but an awful lot of the things that the socialists want are not exactly things that they really believe in. They're just things that destroy the American culture. And if your party hates America, you want to cause all that disorder. So what I'm talking about right here, this is all cultural apologetics. Ravi Zacharias does a little bit of this right now. But C.S. Lewis also used fictional writings. He understood human beings are not just rational beings, but we're also creatures of imagination. And God not only desires that our reason be submitted to him, but he loves the whole man. He wants our imaginations as well. Therefore, C.S. Lewis saw that it's a very successful way to defend the faith. You don't always have to have the best arguments if you could tell the best stories. If you could teach Christian truth by telling stories, there will be people who will come to Christ that wouldn't have come to Christ through rational arguments. And so this is what I call narrative apologetics. And so you can see where C.S. Lewis is a verificationalist, but he's also a combinationalist because he's also a cultural apologist and a narrative apologist. Okay? And so his Chronicles of Narnia, the Pilgrim's Regress, Out of the Silent Planet, the Screwtape Letters, that's a fun read. Everything is backwards. So God's the bad guy, and the good guy is actually Satan, and you got a more experienced demon training a rookie demon, and everything's backwards. But he shows a lot of, you know, Lewis's biblically based ideas on the way demons seek to infiltrate our lives. Yeah. And then that hideous strength. And so he's got these other novels as well. So he's a verificationalist who's eclectic enough in his approach to use other methods like cultural apologetics and narrative apologetics. And so that would classify him as a combinationalist as well. Okay, let's take a break. About a 6 minute break.